It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hi, I'm Omar Kelly, Dolphins columnist for the Miami Herald, and this is the first time that I'm actually being part of this podcast. I'm joined now by Barry Jackson, infamous Barry Jackson, who has been part of the Miami Herald team since when, Barry?
1986, going on 40 years, almost as long as they gave Tannehill to prove if he was the guy.
Good reference there. At least we did pull the plug when we pulled the plug on Tannehill, who surprisingly still hasn't found work. I'm a little perplexed by that, just because of how bad NFL quarterbacking has been and the fact that they don't have a job for Ryan Tannehill.
It's puzzling. He's at least functional at this point. At least he's ambulatory, right? So he could be a backup for someone. It's odd that he hasn't found work, unless his asking price is too high to be a backup.
I don't know. He's probably going to be a future in television. But right now, let's get into what the people are here for, Barry, which is our breakdown of this Dolphins draft class 2024. Let me set the table. I think everybody came into this draft with the expectation that they were going to address the defensive tackle position. Maybe they added an interior offensive lineman who could potentially move outside to tackle. We knew where the issues were with pass rushing in terms of Jalen Phillips and Bradley Chubb's injury. You obviously had depth issues there. Three safeties on the roster in Javon Holland and Jordan Poyer and Elijah Campbell. Anything else I'm missing? Because we had wide receiver, no slot receiver, or no number three unless you're ready to ride it again with Braxton Berrios and River Craycraft. How many of those needs do you think that they filled and addressed in the 2024 draft?
I'm not sure they filled many. I guess you're projecting that Chop Robinson will be a top four edge player for you. The question is it safe to project that, knowing that obviously there wasn't the volume production at Penn State? There's clearly elite traits and the ability to grow into a top four guy with Chubb and Phillips when they're back and with Shaq Barrett. But can you automatically assume that he can be in your edge rotation to start the year? So I think they filled that and they added fast slot receivers. But beyond that, I'm not sure what needs they filled. They still emerge from this, in my view, Omar, without a good enough defensive tackle to replace Wilkins. You know, Gallimore and Jonathan Harris are functional guys. We'll see if Tart can play in Wilkins' spot or if he's strictly a nose. So to me, that's still a big need. Guard, it's still the same cast of characters. The law firm of Jack Driscoll, Liam Eikenberg, and Rob Jones competing for that job. You don't have a backup boundary receiver at this point, so I'd be concerned about that. You don't really have a number three safety. I know we both like Elijah Campbell. Nick Needham's going to get a look there, but who is your veteran number three safety if Poyer or Holland goes down? Who's your backup veteran boundary corner? So I'm not sure what needs were filled. I don't think it was a terrible draft, and we'll get into that, but as far as plugging in needs, it seems to me these four or five things are going to have to be filled in free agency, no?
Well, here's the thing, and I'm glad you brought up Nick Needham, because I've been a little bit puzzled and perplexed and tried to get into that with Chris Greer in terms of how they felt about the safety position. I remember watching practice, and we all know Nick Needham can play safety. We also know that Ethan Bonner has been used as a dime safety.
Bonner's an option there. Needham's an option there as well. But as you wrote yesterday on MiamiHerald.com, cheap plug here, you wrote about a slew of veteran safeties who are still available. Which of that group do you think would be agreeable to being a number three, not getting starter snaps? Because there are some interesting names on that list who they can afford.
I don't think anybody would be agreeable to being a number three. The two names that do intrigue me is Justin Simmons, primarily because, one, he's a Florida native, and two, we know he's a superstar in the league, or at least he has been. Why his market hasn't been as good as many people projected? Maybe he was waiting till after the draft. But then he was released. So why would he need to wait till after the draft? Because he's not a factor into the compensatory pick formula. Same thing with Jamal Adams. And I do have a level of intrigue with Jamal Adams. I don't know where this perception is that Jamal is a bad NFL player. 3 years ago, he was the top defensive player in the Jets. Seattle traded him for two first-round picks. Obviously, this is a young man who's got a ton of talent. Could Anthony Weaver use him in a Kyle Hamilton-esque role? I know he can't do everything that Kyle Hamilton did, but he's a good football player, or has proven that he's a good football player. The question is, can he stay healthy? I don't know. But I do have a level of interest in Justin Simmons. I look at that from the standpoint, if the Dolphins sign Justin Simmons, they could put Javon Holland into that nickel role, or put Javon Holland into that star role and move him around and make him more of a utility piece like he was at Oregon. So don't act like he hasn't been filling that role before. Now, the question is, would Javon be interested in that role, considering that's going to cost him money? You're in a money season. You're in a contract year. I'm sure he's looking at some of these safety contracts and saying, you know, hey, I'd like to get into that top five salary range. And if you put me in a nickel and star player role, unless I'm the whole defense is built around me, I'm going to struggle. So, yeah, that's one of the areas that I'm a little bit intrigued by in terms of what they will do at safety. I don't think there's any rush. Maybe they figure out what they have in-house before they actually go out there and try to pursue something. But you brought up the defensive tackle position. And, Barry, are you not comfortable with the seven that they signed? I mean, there's seven new defensive tackles on the roster. None of them make you comfortable?
Oh, my gosh. What a pedestrian group. And I say that with all due respect to Neville Gallimore and to Jonathan Harris.
I don't think you can call people a pedestrian group and then say with all due respect.
Yeah, right. It probably cannot be done. So I like your idea of Calais Campbell. I know, obviously, long in the tooth, his best days are behind him. But to me, that's something, if I were Greer, I would pursue, just because it gives you a proven, established starter. He played a lot of snaps for the Falcons last year. And then you can at least feel comfortable that if you're playing with three defensive linemen, and remember, the Dolphins started Raekwon with Wilkins and Sealer 7 games last year, 48 over his career. So there are a lot of packages where you have three down linemen on the team. I would feel comfortable then with Calais Campbell, Zach Sealer, and Tart, who is the better run defender, in my view, than Benito Jones, who obviously is your other option at nose tackle. So that's something I would pursue. My fear, Omar, and we've talked about this off air, my fear is they're going to be gouged against the run at times, which has not been a problem in recent years because they've had a good run defense, allowing 3.8 yards per carry last year, tied for third in the league. They still have good run defenders in David Long, maybe the best inside or one of the best inside linebacker run defenders in football. Sealer obviously is good against the run. Tart historically has been good against the run during his better years with Tennessee before his falling out last year. Jordan Brooks is pretty good against the run. Phillips has made major progress against the run. Chubb is fine. But the interior of the defense, can you rely on 900 snaps a year between Neville Gallimore and Jonathan Harris, or does that make you, as the great Joe Philbin would say, queasy?
Don't forget about Benito Jones. Don't forget about, Tier Tart. I'm curious. And also, let's not pretend like guys aren't going to be waived and going to be added to the crop of talent, or that Chris Greer can't go trade a seventh round pick for somebody that another team is trying to dump. I don't think we're done. Well, seven is a lot of bodies. But I'm curious. I think they're going to go into this figuring out what they have in training camp and maybe the OTAs, and then sort of exploring from there. In regards to Calais Campbell, and I have not talked to anybody specifically in his camp, but Calais is at that veteran status where he's not participating in any offseason program. If Calais Campbell signs with the team, he's probably showing up just for training camp. So I don't think there's a rush there. And then if you look at his productivity in his film from last year, Calais has been Calais his entire career now. And at this point, there's nobody young you want to develop. So you're not losing snaps by signing him and adding him to your team. To me, that would be the top issue that I address. But let's segue a little bit to the wide receiver position, because I thought how they handled it in this draft was very intriguing. They added to the, I'll call them the Washington brothers. They added two slot specific players in the later rounds of the draft, adding to a Smurf unit of wide receivers where literally everybody is under 6 foot one, except for Eric Uzukama. I don't know what their vision is for Jody Fortson, whether he's a tight end or he's a wide receiver, or he's just a H-back weapon. I have no idea. But does it intrigue you that they went two slot receivers?
Yes, I agree with you. I have concerns about the Smurfish receiver group. I find it odd that I have action figures of all of these guys, and they're all taller than the actual players, because all the Dolphins receivers are Smurfs. It's incredible, except for Ezukama. So obviously there was high production with Malik Washington, led the nation in catches with 110. I like the fact that he broke 35 tackles. That shows that he has strength in the lower body. So he's an interesting player. By all accounts, Taj Washington from USC could have been drafted in the fifth or sixth round, but they're both similar guys, not the exact same player, but both smallish slots. So
and,
where does that
and similar to Braxton Berrios and River Craycraft. So exactly. Now you have basically four players who kind of play the same role. We don't necessarily know what the vision is for Mike McDaniel, but why do you think they went so slot heavy?
Yeah, I guess just intrigued by the two players, a conviction about both, loving the yak that both offer, loving the speed, loving the elusiveness. But tell me this, among the boundaries who are left in free agency, who makes your toes tingle the most, like Jim Bandich would say? Is it Odell? Are you willing to compromise and give him $6 to $8 million a year instead of three? Obviously, he made 15 last year. Do you go back to Tyler Boyd, try to compromise with him? Does DJ Chark intrigue you? Would Michael Thomas intrigue you? Or does the injury history now over the last 4 years scary off? Because they clearly need another boundary, another backup boundary, right?
Absolutely. I think you mentioned Tyler Boyd would probably be out of the mix for me just from he's a slot specific player. You're kind of heavy on the slot already. And throw in there that probably Tyreek's best position is the slot. Jalen Waddle has experience playing the slot. I think Jalen could probably utilize more in the slot, maybe make him more of a high volume player, especially since he's entering a contract year. You know, Mike McDaniel likes to take care of guys when it's time to make the money. I do have a level of interest in Michael Thomas. Odell Beckham is just going to be, if we're talking about more than $6 million a year for Odell Beckham Jr. at this stage in his career, I'm out. No offense to him, but the resources can, if I had to choose paying Justin Simmons $6 million a year or Odell Beckham $6 million a year as a number three receiver, or Calais Campbell $6 million a year. I only think you have one in the $18.5 million that you're going to get back for Xavier Howard. I think you only have room for one $6 million a year player. And if I'm going to be able to put my resources somewhere, it's going to go to Calais Campbell. If I'm paying one guy $6 million a year, it's going to go to Calais Campbell because, as you pointed out, I do have concerns about my run stuffing.
I'll tell you the other thing on receiver. I agree with you about receiver in this sense. You're going to have more targets this year go to Waddle, as you mentioned. You're going to have more targets go to Jonnu Smith, targets that didn't exist last year. So if you're thinking of signing a high-volume number three receiver – who has a history of catching a lot of passes and that expectation, it's not going to work from a team chemistry standpoint unless that guy subjugates his ego and says, yes, I'm okay if you throw me only 35 passes this year. Whether it's Beckham, whether it's DJ Chark, whoever it is, they have to come in knowing that targets are going to be limited. Look just at Braxton Berrios last year. 16 targets in the first four games, 17 over the final 13 games of the season. And fortunately, he's a team-oriented guy, right, Omar, where he's not going to complain about it. But if you sign, and I don't want to call these guys divas, but if you sign a receiver who is historically used to catching...
You call them divas. Prone, you're insinuating that they're divas.
I was insinuating divas.
I don't know if DJ Chark is a diva.
Right, but what's the expectation for him after being a starter, obviously, in his career, Jacksonville, Carolina, et cetera? Is he going to come in thinking, oh, I'm going to get 50 passes thrown, when no, you might get 35 as they split snaps obviously, among Berrios, you have the two tight ends who will get some targets. You have running backs who obviously are going to get targets out of backfield. You're going to throw Tyreek 150 passes, and Waddle should get 100 targets. So what exactly is left? You need a boundary number three, backup boundary number three, as we've talked about. But what is the realistic expectation of how involved he's going to be?
You make a valid point. I'm also not ruling out the Eric Uzukama developmental program. We know it hasn't gone as well as we had hoped in the first two seasons, but he has shown some ability. And I think he's at the desperate and hungry point of his career. And I always love that point, because once you start dangling the carrot, like your NFL future is on the line, guys start to get it into gear. But you know what? From a receiver standpoint, I look at this as an opportunity where you can go out there and you can get an aged, established, accomplished veteran who wants to live in Miami, wants to play for a competitive team, and knows that he's in the $2 million a year range. And that's a Michael Thomas. I know Jarvis Landry is not coming here primarily because of his history with the organization. And right now, thankfully, Jarvis is getting a rookie camp tryout with the Jacksonville Jaguars. Can you believe that? Jarvis Landry, a Pro Bowl player, has to humble himself to get a rookie camp tryout with the Jacksonville Jaguars. But hey, sometimes that's the point where you put yourself in your career when you're, as I refer to Jarvis, he's a dog who's been known to bite owner. So, you know, sometimes you got to humble yourself and get in the door wherever you can get in. But best of luck to Jarvis. But I'm fine with the Michael Thomas. We can, you know, would I love to add him now and have him learn the offense and have him, you know, get up to speed? Am I fine with Robbie Chosen coming back? I you know, or Chase Claypool? You know, maybe obviously they haven't shown any interest in Chase Claypool, and it's understandable why. Because he's such a slow learner, slow processor. But we added two rookie slot receivers. It's, you know, obviously they're gonna try to invest in them and see what comes from that. And then Eric Uzukama, we're not off that reservation yet. So would I like for them to have done better? Yes. But clearly that wasn't where Mike McDaniel's focus was, Barry.
So I'm like you. I would put my order of needs at this point: defensive tackle. We both agree that they really haven't replaced Wilkins effectively enough. Number two for me would either be number three safety, as you said, or a guy who could start with Javon playing some nickel, although Javon obviously warrants every down snaps as a talent. Number three for me would be boundary receiver. Number four for me would be guard. Now, I know I have guard lower on my list than a lot of fans do. I would say the questions that you and I and the other writers get asked the most, besides Will Fuller's finger a couple of years ago, it was Isaiah Wynn. When's he coming back last year? And now, what guard are they going to sign? As if this collection of guards is going to lead them to the AFC Championship game. So as far as the guards go, what I can share is that there's been a preliminary conversation with Dalton Reisner. Everyone is noting, obviously, the history with Butch Barry, and he's still a serviceable starter. Greg Van Roten, there has been a preliminary conversation with him. And these talks, by the way, go back weeks. And those two would probably be the best options available. The question is, and Greer and McDaniel are going to have to get in the room and decide this, is it worth bringing in any of those guys on a low money contract? Or do you go into August thinking we have enough with Jack Driscoll, who is a part-time starter, primarily backup in Philly, and Rob Jones and Liam Eichenberg? You would do what if you were in Chris Greer's office right now with executive power?
You're watching Dolphins in Depth. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I will address Barry's question on my favorite unit, the offensive line.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, Barry, you brought up an excellent point. Even Mike McDaniels knows my obsession with offensive linemen and trench play. I want to address, before we talk about guard, what they did in the draft, which I totally understand in terms of Patrick Paul, Houston offensive tackle, longest wingspan in the draft, 6'7", 330 pounds, 30 reps of 225 in terms of strength in the bench press. The one thing when you talk to scouts and evaluators, they say he is a left tackle only. Maybe he could swing to right, but he's played left tackle his entire career. This is a young guy that you're going to draft and develop behind Teron Armstead. And as we all know, Barry, Teron Armstead does not participate in minicamp. He does not participate in the OTAs. He does not participate in training camp. He practices once a week to make it to Sundays. And I think we're all fine with that. Correct, Barry?
Absolutely. And also, if you're going to draft a guy who's going to eventually, ideally, replace a starter, Teron is the perfect guy to be the mentor because he's actually going to help this young man. He's not going to be actively lobbying against him because Teron's a good soul and a mentor by nature. So I think he's the ideal person to help mentor Paul. I like the pick in the sense that his pass protection was obviously exemplary at Houston, but he needs to get stronger as a run blocker. The question is he going to have enough functional strength and time to be an effective run blocker? Saban's comments encourage me because I generally trust Saban's evaluation, aside from Jason Allen, you know, small aside there just between us. And obviously the Culpepper Breezy. But
Ronnie Brown over Aaron Rodgers.
Just that small thing too. But I generally trust when he says this is a developmental guy who has a skill set where we think something can be made of him if he improves his strength. The question is, and we're not going to know this until it happens, if Teron is cut after this season with no guaranteed money due, obviously beyond 2024. Is Patrick Paul ready to be an NFL starting left tackle in 2025? How the heck are they going to know unless he gets snaps in games this year? And the question also is this. Does Kendall Lamb play ahead of him?
Yes. Absolutely going to know because Toronto's not going to practice.
So they'll see him in three preseason games. We'll see him in scrimmages against probably two teams in August. Here's my question to you. Who is your number three tackle? Do you go into this year thinking it's going to be Kendall Lamb? Do you open up the competition between Paul and Lamb? And would it worry you if Kendall Lamb plays all year ahead of Patrick Paul as your number three?
It wouldn't because Kendall Lamb played so admirably last year in his eight starts, was phenomenal. And it name me the game where you looked at that film and you said, man, Kendall Lamb's a problem. I don't think that existed. So to me, everybody has to earn their opportunity. Everybody has to earn their snaps. Kendall Lamb has certainly going to get every opportunity. He's probably going to be playing more right tackle unless Jack Driscoll settles in as the right guard, right tackle. But then I also think that Jack Driscoll could be the right guard starter, but I definitely know he's the right side guy. To me, Patrick Paul is going to be on a developmental program and he's going to have to get functionally stronger. He's going to have to show that he can, if he shows that he can be an asset at moving from the tackle spot or getting to the second level, I think he's got a good chance to play because the pass protection has been stellar. But to address the draft pick in the second round at pick 55, when you looked at that board, you had two options. You could choose a tackle and primarily a right tackle, if you wanted a day one starter. We all know the Dolphins don't need a right tackle. You could have chose a polished left tackle like Patrick Paul, or you could have went the guard route in a Cooper Beebe or some of the
Connecticut
guys for some of the guys who were out there, the kid from Connecticut. And when you look at offensive line play and offensive line positions, you should not be drafting a guard high. Unless he's stellar or elite. And I don't think that was necessarily there on the board. So I understood why they went the left tackle route, while they went with the guy with the huge upside if he develops and he pans out. And then when we talked to the young man, charismatic, high energy, you could definitely see that he's going to fit in well into the culture of the organization. You know, and the question is, obviously, how much is he going to get caught up in the Miami streets? He doesn't look like a kid who's going to get caught up in the Miami streets, but you never know. So I understood the pick, but what I think a lot of people had issue with is that it left them exposed at guard, especially when you pick up a running back in day three and trade up for a running back when there were still guards on the board. And hell, there were guards and centers still on the board in the sixth and seventh round, and they completely ignored it. I understood why they ignored it, because they were selecting players that they valued higher on their boards as opposed to the guard spot. But then that, to me, that hints that they're all on board with Liam Eichenberg. They're okay with riding the Eichenberg Express. And I don't have an issue with that. If that's the route that you're going to go, I don't have an issue with it at all.
Yeah, I don't either. What would concern me is this. Isaiah Wynn, whose pass protection was exceptional in his seven games before the quad injury against Philly in week seven, he historically has had injury issues. So my concern would be if Isaiah Wynn goes down again, then you're again going to be in a situation where in November and December, you're going to be playing backup players at guard. Then you're going to have a combination of Lester Cotton, who apparently has nine lives, and Liam Eichenberg and Jack Driscoll and Rob Jones. So do you want two of those four to be your guard combination in key games in December and ideally January? Because unfortunately for Isaiah Wynn, we wish him all the best. We hope he stays healthy. But the historical body of work has been he's a guy who typically gets injured. So I guess for me, the case to sign Van Roten or Risner would be just to protect yourself in case there's an injury to Wynn. Then you'd have five guards, of which two would emerge as starters, probably Wynn on the left side, probably Risner, Van Roten, if you sign him. So to me, injury concern would be the reason to sign them, even though we're not convinced that Risner and Van Roten at this point are necessarily appreciably better than Liam, who has improved, unquestionably. Rob Jones has certainly been serviceable during his time. I don't think we view Cotton as a really appealing option. A very nice gentleman, Lester Cotton, but really has not been able to sustain success when he's gotten his chance. And we'll see what Driscoll can do. So I'm not as worried about guard as the general public is. Are you?
You know what? I'm going to throw one name at you and see if it piques your interest. Keon Smith has been a developmental player for this organization for 2 years. He's athletic enough. He's playing tackle, but we've also seen him work at guard. He's athletic enough to be a guard and get to the second level. Maybe if he loses 15 pounds, his body would be custom fit for guard. It seems to me, just talking to Mike McDaniel and how much he rubbed in the Patrick Paul selection to me on draft night, because he knows my obsession with offensive line help, it seems to me like they have a master plan. And I do believe that master plan includes Liam Eichenberg, who this organization has a much higher opinion of than we, the fan base, or we, the media. Yes, I know I beat up on Liam Eichenberg a ton last year when he was struggling, when he was playing with broken ribs, when he was playing center. But in that one game where he played right guard, it looked like it was a position that was custom fit for him. And I watched that performance, and I think, I can't remember the game, but I think he was like one of the top two performers. And then he even had to move to left guard because somebody else got hurt, which is the history of the Dolphins offensive line, which is why I'm always queasy about it. But when I saw that performance, I said, they're letting Robert Hunt walk. Because
yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Instead of, at that time, I thought Robert Hunt would be a $10 million player. Oh boy, was I wrong. But at that time, I thought to myself, right guard is probably should be the one of the least expensive positions in the NFL. If you have a guy who you can play there for at least one more season at a minimum salary till you find a replacement for him, it just makes sense. And then Isaiah Wynn. But do I have a comfort level that both of the players that are playing at those ideal starting spots, whether it be Isaiah Wynn or Liam Eichenberg or maybe even Rob Jones or Lester Cotton or Keon Smith, do I have a comfort level that they're going to start for 16 games and the drop off from the starter to the backup isn't going to be a massive cavern? I do have some issues, which is why I probably address that position in free agency. However, I'm not paying big money for Dalton Risner. I believe he made $4 million last year signing at the last minute with Minnesota. So he's one of those guys who knows his price point. He knows his value. And no disrespect to him because, hey, you know, but he's in the exact same spot he was last year. And here he is sitting out, holding out, waiting out for a $3 to $4 million a year gig. More power to you, but you know, I'm not interested in it right now.
I wouldn't rule out Phil Haynes as an option either. He visited the Seattle starter for 7 games last year. Sometimes the Dolphins will circle back to guys who visited early in the offseason, so he's an option as well. But I'm like you. I'm a little bullish on Liam because we've seen improvement. Really, the only horrendous game he had last year was a tough situation, October 1st in Buffalo, and Connor Williams was injured against that Bills defensive front. Your first real game action at center, of course you're going to struggle. So he was really bad that day, but I thought he was competent his other appearances last season. And
remember, he finished the season playing injured because I forget what the injury was, but the final month of the season, he was basically only practicing once a week and then still played respectable. What would a healthy Liam look like?
Right, and we know he's not a tackle as far as a long-term starter, but remember, this was a guy who went 2.5 years at Notre Dame, a major program playing against Power Five schools, who didn't give up a sack. So there's ability there. We both admire his toughness. We both admire his preparation skills. So I want to see more. He's far from a bust, and he could end up being a serviceable NFL starter at guard. So I would make that number 4 on my list of needs. Is there any other needs we think they need to address in free agency that we're forgetting? Another corner? Because right now you're looking at, in whatever order, 3 through 7 is Kohu, who has a lot to prove after struggling last year. Needham, who they're going to play at both safety and corner. Ethan Bonner, who, everyone in the room jokes he's the great white hope, right? Because he talked about being a Caucasian cornerback with us last year. So you have those three. Saron Neal, who's been primarily a special teams player for the Bills. And, of course, Cam Smith, who's the other guy besides Isaiah Wynn that everyone asked about last year.
It's funny that you leave his name for last. But, yeah, I think you're going to have to give Cam every opportunity, and then Ethan Bonner as well. I remember watching him in training camp last year and thinking to myself, there's something to him. There's something there. When you can hang with Tyreek Hill from a coverage standpoint, not say you could cover him, but you could actually be in the area. You've got some legitimate speed. We know where Nick Needham is. Maybe you add a Roxin Yah, or I can't remember his name.
Exactly.
Maybe you add a veteran later on in the process, you know, either the Eli Apple type later on in the process, maybe if one guy goes down. But cornerback is not necessarily a position of need that I'm trying to address right now. And hell, the Dolphins found Nick Needham and Kader Kohu as undrafted rookies. Maybe one of these undrafted rookies are going to be a rookie sensation.
Yes, and I'll tell you the guy who really intrigues me to see in May and June, Mo Kamara, because if he shows them enough, then maybe you don't need to bring in another edge off the street, because if you cautiously plan for a September without Bradley Chubb, but with Phillips, then who is your edge rusher behind Jalen Phillips and Shaq Barrett? Is it Chop Robinson, and he's developing? Is it Kamara? It's not going to be Cam Good, who has the torn patella, so he's probably not going to be the guy. So do you still need to sign another veteran edge? Now, here's my question about Kamara. Obviously, monster numbers at Colorado State, the 13 sacks last year, a pressure rate that compared with the Latus, the Dallas Turners, the Jared Verses of the world, just as good as their pressure rates, obviously not at a Power 5 school. The question is, can you show enough in pajamas in May to give a team a strong enough impression about whether you can count on this mid-round draft pick as a rotational edge player for you this offseason? Or do you need to cover yourself by signing a veteran edge at the minimum who's looking for work in late July?
Oh, we can always break the Melvin Ingram glass and break in case of emergency glass. I think that they'll go young. They'll go developmental. They'll see what they have there all of training camp and OTAs and practice is going to be Patrick Paul versus Mo Kamara and Chop Robinson. So we'll be able to see and assess. But at this point, if it's not defensive line help, or not safety help. I'm letting it be, and I'm seeing what young player develops. But let's wrap up the pod. Let's wrap up the podcast, Dolphins in depth with this, Barry. I'm going to ask you this question, and I want a convicted answer from you. Give me the one player in this draft class that you're gonna predict the Dolphins are gonna have to worry about re-signing in 4 years.
Oh, that's a great one. Because running backs are traditionally easy to re-sign, Jalen Wright might end up being their best player in this class. He's probably not gonna be difficult to re-sign, but obviously he's the future running back with A-Chain looking 2 years from now down the line. I would say probably Robinson, but I don't have a conviction about it. It's the whole issue, Omar, and this is what we and fans will debate until we see if Chop Robinson can play or not. Do you value more the traits and pressure on quarterback, or do you value more the tangible production? Because a tangible production clearly was lacking. To have 15 tackles in 10 games to me is a big red flag. Also, of the four sacks, obviously, as Mel Kiper and others have noted, two against UMass. But it's interesting. Greer and coaches with this organization over the last 10 years have historically placed pressures on a pedestal side by side with sacks, or even more importantly, saying that they value it even more. So this is going to be the quintessential debate that we have about Chop Robinson until we see definitive evidence of whether the guy can play or not. I was a little uncomfortable with the lack of production, despite the athleticism, despite the speed, despite all the appealing traits. It just worries me a little bit. Didn't you find it interesting that Chris Greer already had in his bag of tricks during the media session on Thursday night the Danielle Hunter story, right? Obviously had a guy already in his mind, 4.5 sacks in his career at LSU, almost 90 as an NFL player, because he knew the question would be asked.
You know what? I did find that very ironic, but I think that that's something that they probably addressed and discussed in the draft room for weeks when they were putting their board together. I think the one thing about Chop Robinson we know is that he was universally a top 20 player on their draft board. If they had 16 legitimate first round picks, he was in that board, probably number 16 or probably number 15, but he was 16. He was definitely projected. And I don't know a single draft evaluator that didn't have Chop Robinson in his top 20 players. Now, I will make the argument that once we get past 20, it's a whole lot of second rounders in this draft class. And that was my biggest issue with this draft class. But Chop Robinson did belong in that first round selection. What I don't like is that he's the least of the polished pass rushers of the first round batch. But you know what? They have shown throughout the years they draft premium positions early. They did that again this year. And so I'm going to go with Patrick Paul. There was just something about the young man who the moxie, the charisma. We know the wingspan is ridiculous. As Mike McDaniel says, he fills more of the hallway than he doesn't. And just watching some of his film from the Senior Bowl, I saw tools. I saw somebody who needed to learn how to use those tools. And when you put Teron Armstead's mentorship and development, and I will say this, if you ask me which member of the Miami Dolphins coaching staff will I give the most leeway to in 2024, my answer would be Butch Barry. And so if this is a guy that Butch Barry identified and said that I want, I'm going to say, okay. And with Chris Greer's history of drafting offensive linemen, which has been relatively shaky, if I'm Chris Greer, I'm stepping out of it and I'm saying, Butch, who would you like? All right, that's who we're going to get. So hopefully that was the case. And Patrick Paul will develop and turn out to be somebody reliable. But hell, we've drafted a ton of tackles that we've moved inside the guard over the years. If that's what it's got to come down to, or maybe Patrick Paul is just a swingman tackle for the duration of his career in Miami, c'est la vie. So it will be. But always pleasure joining you, Barry. This is the first of many Dolphins in-depth podcasts that we'll do. We're still figuring out the schedule, but you know how to find the conversation here at the Miami Herald, and you know how to find our work. Barry's got 16,000 stories up already. On that note, we will see you next episode.